All right. So thank you, everyone, for your indulgence. Again, sorry for my being late. My name is Brendan Sharkey. I'm the chairman of the Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations. And this is the subcommittee, the Local Government of the Future subcommittee meeting. And with me is our vice chair, Lau Ray, as well as other members of ACIR who are joining us as we speak. So this is, as we all know, a meeting that is being held via Zoom. So therefore, as usual, if there are members of the public or members of ACIR who wish to be recognized for comment, question, or otherwise, please do your raise hand function on your screen or wave your hands wildly and I'll recognize you so that you can ask your questions accordingly. This is, I guess we should, I know on our agenda we have a review of the draft meeting notes from the September 28th subcommittee meeting. I don't know if we normally don't hold votes on that, but did anyone have any comments or objections to the meeting notes that Bruce drafted up for us from the September subcommittee meeting? If not, we'll take those as accepted, as drafted. Thank you, Bruce, for doing that for us. And then we will launch right into the meat and potatoes of our meeting this morning. Just as a quick reminder, the Local Government of the Future Subcommittee, we've kind of set this committee up as a means to evaluate some of the opportunities that are available post-pandemic for reimagining how we do local government in Connecticut. But over the summer, we gave ourselves the task of looking at the question that came up throughout the legislative session this year regarding home rule and the way the term has been used and perhaps misused by advocates for whatever issue, local issue they have of concern. And we embarked on a multi-month discussion of different aspects of the term home rule, beginning with a legal summary provided to us by Attorney Steve Mendick as to the origins and definitions of the meaning of the term, I should say, and then applying those that law to different aspects of local government that where we've seen the term sort of misused or misapplied. I think we reached a conclusion at our last meeting that we probably have exhausted the topic for the most part, though we do intend to provide to the Planning and Development Committee and other members of the legislature a report on our findings. And we are not going to be dedicated after today, we won't be dedicating our subcommittee meetings to this topic any longer, but instead focusing on some other issues that apply to the LGF initiative generally. But I should inform members of the committee, and we'll do so again at our regular meeting next Friday of the full ACIR, that we did hold a hybrid meeting with the Planning and Development Committee at the chair's request just last week, last Wednesday, at which we gave them a preliminary report on our findings regarding home rule. Parenthetically, I mentioned this was the first in-person meeting of a legislative committee since the pandemic. So there was a little bit of groundbreaking there that took place. And there were the usual glitches here and there with regard to the conduct of the meeting. But overall, it was very successful, I thought. A lot of the topics that we have been discussing were brought and placed on the table. There was some pushback, I think it's fair to say, from some members of the committee who perhaps wanted to to do what we've talked about, which is define home rule in their own terms, rather than by the strict definition of our Constitution and our statutes. So, and I think in the end, there was kind of a baseline understanding that that's not, you know, the facts are the facts and the law is the law. And therefore, we need to be careful in how we apply the term. So all in all, I think it was successful, and I think it was very much appreciated by the chairs that we engaged in this topic and discussion and then offered that baseline understanding of the term for their own members as they look ahead to the 2022 legislative session. But the one topic that we have not taken up at the subcommittee level was kind of the elephant in the room, I think, that really helped promote and prompt us to, you know, take a harder look at these definitional questions regarding home rule, which, of course, is the discussion that went on throughout the 2021 session on changes, potential changes to our zoning laws and other land use laws, which received a lot of pushback from the public and from members of the legislature who applied the term home rule to, you know, I think it's fair to say in some ways suggest that the legislature had no role in redefining local zoning or reapplying how we make land use decisions as if towns and cities are somehow sovereign and are, you know, empowered by our Constitution to go their own way and do whatever they'd like to do if they choose to when it comes to local land use decisions. So we decided to dedicate this one last meeting of our subcommittee to this topic of land use. And there is no better person, I think, to help us on that front than our guest speaker today, who is Tim Hollister, who I've known since my law school days when he was back in the late 80s, when he, as a very young lawyer, was already well-known for his expertise on land use, although Tim's, I don't think, much older than I am. Tim is now a partner at Hinckley Allen and continues to be at the forefront of many land use decisions, some contentious, some otherwise, on behalf of his clients. And he probably more than anyone bears the scars of the battles that he's fought to promote different land use decision-making, but clearly has a handle on how our zoning and land use laws in Connecticut have been affected by some of this misunderstanding, misperception of what home rule means as he goes into these communities on behalf of his clients. I'll just, before I do the introduction, Tim, I'll just say that when I asked him to attend, he pointed out to me that back in 1985, he had a seminal study that was printed in the Connecticut Bar Journal regarding this very topic, the question of home rule and its application to land use. And I have to say, Tim, that you and I are both so old that when I went back through my research materials that are available to us attorneys who are members of the Connecticut Bar, the archives did not go back that far. So I was unable, I wanted to give members a copy of your treatise, and I couldn't get it. So maybe we can fix that by if you still have a copy of it, you can forward to us. But without any further ado, let me just introduce Tim Hollister for this topic. And thank you, Tim, for joining us today.
Well, okay. Good morning. A lot of familiar faces. Nice to see you all. Just so the record straight, I did leave Shipman and Goodwin in February of this year after 28 years there, and I've come over to Hinckley Allen basically to have a little more autonomy over my own shop, and it's worked out very well. I'm going to, apropos of nothing, this is the perfect group for me to ask my all-time favorite Connecticut trivia question, which I'm not going to go give you the answer, but what are the four towns in Connecticut that have the word town in the name? And John Filchak, you're disqualified because you know the answer. So it's kind of a fun question. I think I'm sort of known for my representation of property owners and developers, but I do want to emphasize I have a footprint in the municipal world. I went back and made a list. I have done work for Colchester, Glastonbury, Canton, New Canaan, Stamford, Enfield, West Hartford, and Groton over my career. And I've long been affiliated with the International Municipal Lawyers Association, which is the national group of city and town attorneys. And as Brendan mentioned, I did, back in the 80s, publish this article in the Connecticut Bar Journal, and I have a scan of it, and I have your email, Brendan. So after this, I'll send it around, and we can go from there. I also acknowledge online the two savants of land use law, attorneys Famiglietti and Roberts. So I'll let them correct it, what I say after I say it. So Brendan asked me for a summary of home rule as it applies to land use, and I'll just try to take 7-8 minutes and run down the basic structure. So yes, home rule is enshrined in the state constitution. The towns are the basic unit of government in Connecticut for no other reason than we abolished counties in the 1960s. And town meeting and representative town meeting are very common form of government. Good old, New England grassroots participatory democracy, which I think people would translate into, well, we must have a very strong home rule tradition. But as Brendan alluded to, that's not the case. The three structures of municipal powers in the United States. The first is where local governments have broad inherent powers, which is generally a provision in the state constitution, much like the federal constitution, that any powers not delegated to the state are reserved to the towns. That's one model. Second is there is a limited reservation of powers to the state and to the towns, sort of a hybrid model. And the third model is what's called Dillon's Rule, which is that local governments only have those powers that are expressly delegated by state law or necessarily implied from state law. Connecticut is unequivocally a Dillon's Rule state. We're in the third category. So the illustrations of this are that even though home rule is in the state constitution, that provision is basically a prohibition or a limit on special act legislation. It's not in any way, shape, or form a reservation of undelegated powers to the town. Municipal powers are spelled out in basically two places, 7-1-148 of the general statutes, sometimes called the Municipal Powers Act, and 7-188 through 201, which is the provisions on municipal charters. But even when courts are interpreting either of those, that group of sections, they always look for an express permission for a local law, not the absence of a prohibition and not legislative silence. So the powers are strictly construed. The only inherent realm, if you want to call it that, the series of court cases where local discretion has been upheld as part of the inherent attribute of being a town is matters of truly local concern. And the two sort of most prominent cases are one involving how a town would spend excess tax money. Court said you can do that. It's the local matter. You can do what you want. And how to fill a local office vacancy. You created the office. You can fill it as you. But pretty much everything else. And there's a long line of cases from the 1950s through the 1980s in my 1985 article just one after another, charter provisions, local ordinances that went against any state statute, just invalidated as not being authorized under our home rule system. On top of that, you have preemption, which if there's a state law that either conflicts with a local law or so-called occupies the field where the legislature said, we are the only authority that can rule on this, local laws have been invalidated. So that's a long way of saying there are really two key points in the field of land use. The first is we are a small state with 169 towns. And just as an aside, the story I always tell about Connecticut is I gave a talk once in San Antonio, and the young man who took me to the conference room asked me where I was from, and I said Connecticut. And he looked at me quizzically and said, that's one of them small states in the upper right. And I said, yes, that's exactly where it is. But we are a small state, and the legislature has continually signified in land use and other municipal areas that the land use is a statewide concern, and for the most part, we need uniform statewide rules. I have a case in Middletown right now in where the city charter and a bylaw of the zoning commission says that you need 5 affirmative votes to pass anything through the zoning commission. But we have a state statute that says a majority of the full commission of a full zoning commission can enact a zone change. They have a 7-member commission, 4 votes would be a majority. So I have an issue in court, which rules the majority, you know, the state statute about what the voting standard is, or, you know, the city charter. And, you know, we've argued that this is all land use is a statewide issue, and it's certainly a voting standard is a statewide issue, and Middletown can't revise the rules for land use and zoning. Waiting for a decision, I actually expect to prevail on that issue. Last thing I'll say is, so the Zoning Enabling Act, you know, is always interpreted as where's the permission to do what the local land use agency wants to do. And I would just end by saying, you know, in Public Act 21-29, which is sometimes called the Desegregate Connecticut Bill, I think is a resounding further effort by the legislature to, on a case-by-case basis, go through the land use statutes and say, you know, we're going to take back any semblance of local control on, you know, ADL, accessory dwelling units and, you know, affirmative fair housing and all these, the other things that are packed into that bill. So I think that's just a recent reaffirmation that the state legislature considers land use to be a subject to statewide rules with very limited ability of towns to go their own way. So that's the summary, Brendan. I'm happy to obviously answer any questions.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. I think the question or the thing that has troubled our members over the course of this past year, in particular, with the emphasis on zoning in the DSEG Connecticut movement, has just been the dealing with this sense that towns, exactly to the contrary of what you just described, that towns, that the state has no business diving into what is ultimately local authority or local control over their own zoning decisions. Do you have the Middletown example and case that you're doing now is a terrific example of the misperception or misapplication of the notion of home rule. You know, our local zoning code says we can do this, and you know, I think you're right. It sounds to me like your argument is pretty sound that no, the statutes say something completely different, and you're not able to override what a statute already expresses. So are there other examples of situations that you've discovered where folks have really vehemently opposed a lot of action or legislation or statutory authority based upon the misunderstanding of what home rule really means. Using the term home rule, but misunderstanding what it actually means.
Yeah, well, obviously we've heard home rule, local choice advocated a lot against 830G and in favor of, you know, paring it back, dismantling it, repealing it. And, you know, obviously 830G was an act of the legislature that was, that followed the 1989 Blue Ribbon Commission chaired by Terry Tondreau and Anita Baxter and the report, which is sitting up on my shelf here, said that that whenever you know, sort of luxury 2-acre lot subdivisions were being proposed, development got a free pass, but anything that was multifamily or income or rent restricted was being subjected to different standards. And so the legislature stepped in I think the point is, The Tondreau Commission did not consider itself as doing, you know, breaking new ground in home rule. They were exercising the power of the state to pare back on what they thought were you know, misuses or abuses, or at least failure to respond to the huge uptick in housing prices and rent that we saw in the 1980s. So, you know, there was no, you read the report, there was no hesitation, you know, are we cutting back on Connecticut's home rule tradition. No, it was just very, very much assumed that the legislature had the right to do exactly what it did. Not that any, there was, of course, a lot of pushback at the local level as to what they did, but nobody disputed that they had the right to do that. So, you know, so there's always pushback in the affordable housing area, but, you know, I obviously 2129, I mean, you know, ask Sarah Bronin and her team. I mean, what they started with and what they ended with, I think, was mostly pared back based on the assertion of, you know, the town should be allowed to do what they want. And because zoning, you know, we hear the phrase zoning is a promise, zoning is a matter of local concern. And so that viewpoint, I think, prevailed on a fair number of things that were withdrawn from the original bill. So that's a very good recent example, I think.
Right. We at our meeting with the Planning and Development Committee, one of the ranking members really, really emphasized, yeah, but, you know, I know what you're saying about the law and about the Constitution, but, you know, there's this tradition here in Connecticut of local control over, you know, all these decisions. And that's our history. That's our tradition. So I know that the laws say this, but really we have to sort of work around that because that's not our history. And I, you know, politely, we push back a bit on that topic. And Steve Bendick did a pretty good job of being politic in the way he responded to that. But that is the perception, isn't it, that for a lot of officials, both at the local and the state level, that there is somehow this mythical history that empowers towns to do whatever they want to do.
Well, let me draw this distinction. I mean, tradition is a small T word. It's not a legal word. We have 169 towns. They each, you know, the joke among the land use lawyers is only one F in fiefdom, or two Fs in fiefdom. You know, in other words, the legislature has delegated a broad set of powers to 169 small towns, which are staffed by volunteers. And up until really 830G, the court system was deferential. I mean, that was really why, you know, appeals involving affordable housing were being swatted down left and right before 830G was enacted, because the courts would give deference to, you know, local understanding of conditions and so forth. So it's paring back. There is a tradition of deference, but the legislature has always had the ability to pare back on that deference. That's the tradition versus the legal rights and structure of our state. if that makes any sense.
That's a great point. That's a great point. I'm glad you clarified. I was, for the record, I was a student of Terry Tondros, but not yet out of law school. And I guess I had just gotten out of law school when that report was issued. But I was baptized in the affordable housing effort and tradition, thanks to Terry and the work that you and Terry were doing together at the time. So, other questions from the group? Lyle.
Thank you. What Tim just said, I think, is an extremely important point, which is the historic deference to towns on land use is not the same thing as legal control or legal power. And I think that actually, you know, goes back even before you two. I think it's part of the English local law tradition where, you know, towns were allowed to sort of do what they want with land use. The crown didn't intervene in land use. And I think here, when we had newer states than Connecticut, they were far away from state capitals and sort of did their own thing. But I think that historic deference is confused with power. And I think that's an extremely important point. In other words, I think there is a legal deference to towns in terms of their local land use. And it is overridden, and that's the term we use, for group homes and other public purposes. But, you know, the term override implies something, which is, in other words, the local historical deference is set aside for broader public purposes, such as deinstitutionalization of people with disabilities and so on and so forth. But I think that there's a nub in there, Brendan and Tim, which is the historic deference of to towns on land use controls can be confused by some as a constitutional or legal right of some sort. And I know I'm maybe one of the few people here that actually goes back. I wasn't at the beginning of the Dillon rule, but I've been on several commissions in the Midwest years ago where we were pounded with the Dillon state that local governments are creatures of state government. You know, that's sort of the motto. But I think that historic deference being confused with intrinsic power, I think, is a very important point. People, some of the comments made at our conversation recently, Brendan, you know, I think there's a confusion there that yes, in fact, the state does generally defer to local government and land use. That is true. Because there's too many decisions. We need to, you know, the state government doesn't want to be talking about the location of every stop sign or street, but that deference is not intrinsic power. So that's my observation. I think it's a very important point you just made there. That
right. And if the legislature observed that on a statewide or regional basis at the local level, the placement of stop signs was being misused in some way, they have the power to correct that. That's the point.
Exactly. Exactly.
And of course, it's not stop signs.
Figurative stop signs.
Yeah, right.
I mean, things about the local granular stuff that goes on in
right.
Again, at the point when people were using various land use provisions to stop group homes for people with disabilities, the state stepped in and said, "Nope, no can do." Supported by state Supreme Courts across the country, even in very quote unquote local control type states, the state has stepped in and said, "Nope, you know, you can't simply keep out people with disabilities because you don't like them. Not permitted, and too bad." I mean,
and on those, on, you know, as a former politician too, you know, wise politicians will only tread on these topics to assert state authority on issues that really matter, that really, you know, you be careful to assert the authority that is inherently granted. And of course, local folks are going to resist that because that's not been the, you know, that interferes with the deference that is otherwise granted to municipalities. But and state politicians should be wary about stepping into those areas until and unless it's essential. John, I'm sorry, you had a...
Yeah, thank you. And just a, an observation and maybe get your reaction, Tim. What I see at the local level is, you know, in my case, in our towns and across the state, they're all volunteers on these commissions. They're often making, in their decision making, oftentimes it's not necessarily within in line with the statutes, and the applicant, it's just sort of the easier way to get the permit is just to comply and go forward. And so they don't get challenged. And sometimes they don't even seek they ignore the legal review of their own regulations. I have one town, maybe you're familiar with, that does not have zoning, Eastford, which has subdivision regs that go for 200 plus pages. And they read like zoning. They're clearly not authorized to do that, but they've had those in place for 30 plus years. And it's a question of being challenged. And so that when they see something like the bill that we put forward last year from Desegregate, they go, oh, you're trying to take something away. And I've always done it this way. And we've been able to do it this way. Why can't we continue to do it this way? And that's why I was very disappointed that the training piece of that bill was out of there. It's always hard to get volunteers to go to training, but a lot of them just, you know, they jump on these commissions and, well, this is the way we've always done it. And I think that just sort of seeds or perpetuates the myths around what the local powers are relative to what the real powers are.
True. That's exactly correct. Kristen just pointed out that there is a mandatory training provision that's going to kick in. And I believe there was some chat on the planners listserv the other day about what the options are for doing that, whether it's the Bar Association or UConn or others. Be an interesting to see how the training protocols develop, but I think they will.
I'm hoping they are through the bar, and rather than the generalized training that I've seen, which is more how to run a meeting. And
yeah, that's true.
That, to some degree, the commissions need to have the fear of God put into them at some level. Because I've written a lot of regulations and worked with many town attorneys, and it's amazing how many times my advice and the town attorney's advice have been just put aside and say, well, this always has worked until you get sued. Challenged.
I worked with Gilead Community Services in 2015 in Cromwell. I didn't handle the trial, but you saw what happened there.
So did you have a question for Tim, John? Or a comment that you wanted to respond to as far as that goes?
That's what I was looking to just make a comment on right now. I'm just trying to figure out how to craft this report. So this is sort of helping me out on that.
Yeah, good. Great.
I think you could encapsulate what Lyle and I were talking about. Maybe that's a framework that people would understand. The tradition is there, but that's not to be confused with the legal structure.
Yeah. Prior to this, Tim, in talking about this with Steve Mednick as well, that, you know, we also distinguished the terms home rule from local control, making sure that we separate those two. Home rule is really not even applicable in most of these cases. Local control is something granted by the state, and it can be taken away just as easily. So your distinction between tradition and control or authority is another good way to distinguish the topics that oftentimes get confused. Rich, I see your hands. Welcome.
Thanks. I agree with basically everything that Tim has said as far as the legal framework. I think, just serving on a commission as well as representing a lot of smaller towns, I think one of the kind of the flip side of the same issue that has come to the fore, particularly over the last couple of years, is, at what point are things of statewide concern with respect to land use regulation? I don't think any, rational person would, object to statewide concern over things like affordable housing, institutionalized people, and so forth. But, just as a couple of the examples that have come out of the legislature within the last year or so, essentially taking away any local control of outdoor dining hours, the short-term response, codifying the executive order through the end of May of 2022, was one thing, but then the kind of replacement act that takes effect, April 1st thereafter, which basically makes them all as of right with, the requirement that a whole new set of regulations or procedures be put into place, which may undermine, particular important considerations, regarding things like required parking. That suddenly has risen to the level of, an area of statewide concern. And I think probably the friction is more, and I think this is what, kind of was underlying a lot of what the ranking members were saying during the hearing rather than, any substantive legal basis for their arguments was, the one size fits all works sometimes, but sometimes it doesn't. And, it seems like in a lot of instances, things are being pushed down on municipalities without adequate consideration for whether they actually work in that town or not. And while the opt out for things like the parking and the accessory dwelling unit was probably, a political necessity to get anything passed, I think it's important because, as a practical matter, what works in Stamford, Hartford, New Haven, Waterbury, doesn't work in Eastford, Voluntown, and Putnam. There needs to be, some recognition of that fact as, the legislature goes forward and expands the, I don't want to use the word micromanagement, but the more granular control of land use regulations in areas that aren't necessarily ones that people would consider to be of profound public importance. I think that's probably as much what has caused people to start, running up and down the streets yelling home rule as, any, misunderstanding or fundamental objection to Dylan's rule and, legislative authority. But that, that's more of an opinion than a legal argument.
Yeah, that's a great point, Rich. I think maybe that was what I was implying when I, but not articulating clearly, when I was talking about the need for state politicians to be careful when they tread into this area. There are a lot of those considerations that have to be taken into account when deciding to adopt a particular policy initiative that has statewide application. that it's not a one-size-fits-all, and you need to be very precise and careful about how you wield that power for the reasons you've mentioned. So that's a great point. Before I recognize Rich report, I just wanted to let folks know I see my lights flicker in my house a little bit. So if I cut out, you'll know that it wasn't anything personal. I'll try to rejoin. Rick.
Thanks, Brendan. I so appreciate this discussion. It's really interesting. And your comment a few minutes ago about elected representatives needing to have use discretion in when to invoke state authority is super important. I hope it's okay to ask this kind of question. And if not, we can table it or try again later. But if there's a recognition, a growing recognition, that the fact that we separate ourselves by race and income more than most other places in the country, and the fact that we can't produce housing for new families forming or new households forming in a way that hurts our economic competitiveness, does that rise to the level where the state would start to look for ways to exercise some authority about how decisions are made on land use and zoning?
Tim?
Yes, absolutely. And 2129 was a start on that. Actually, 830G was a start on that. 2129. 30 years later was a further iteration of that. But yeah, I was on the panel with Sarah Bronin and a couple others at the Bar Association last fall talking about, exclusionary practices. And, there are prohibitions that are enacted at the local level that, intended to keep certain types of housing and income groups out. And then there are the more indirect ways, what looks like a neutral requirement on paper, but has, so-called disparate impact. And then you, at some point you move to the next level, which is, okay, if there is a challenge to that, is it going to be, deferred to in the courts, or is it going to be overruled as occurred in the Builder Service case in 1988? Or is the legislature invited then to step in and say, okay, on a statewide basis, this is happening enough, it's having a detrimental effect, and we're going to prohibit it or limit it in such a way. So I'll just mention, last week I was appointed by the governor to the Commission on Connecticut's Future and Development, and as a zoning attorney, and I think one of the things I'll be asked to comment on are, if you go through a laundry list of municipal land use regulations, which are the ones that serve a purpose? And I don't just mean development; I mean balance between community rights and the fact that housing markets are not municipal; they're not defined by municipal boundaries. They are at very least regional. And we have to recognize that. So, if an individual town is going to put up a barrier to entry, almost by definition, they're going against not just the law, but the economics and the real estate market dynamic of the situation. So that's a long way of saying that there are both legal and, economic and real estate market reasons for doing exactly what you're talking about, Rick.
Could I just make one quick comment on that? With what Rich and Tim were saying, I often see towns, zoning boards have open discussions about, well, we've got to, and it rolls over to the housing and the race issues as well. We've got to keep the number of kids down in our schools. So the minimum lot size for the bulk of the town in the RA zone will make as large as we can. That's more common than not. It may say 2.5 acre zoning or 2 acre zoning, but in reality, it's five or more, given the topographic and other realities that they throw in and the conditions. And that that is something we may well see addressed in the next session or soon, is that minimum lot size issue.
Yeah, right.
Brendan, just a super quick follow-up. I really appreciate it. I think that the desegregate Connecticut law that Tim referred to was, in my opinion, I hope it's okay to say, a courageous effort to begin to address some of these issues. And I've heard John Filczak say this often. I feel like a lot of our local zoning boards make decisions based on the best interest of their town, at least as they understand them. But not enough consideration is given to the overall economic and social well-being of Connecticut as a whole, of the state as a whole. So it's not, I don't believe people, mostly don't believe people have bad intentions, but how do we elevate the well-being of the state as a whole in decisions that are being made almost exclusively locally? I guess that's my question. And I just wanted to be clear. I think the desegregate law was an important step. And, you know, anyway, I'll stop.
Yeah, Tim, what's your thought on that? You know, the question of at what point what's the tipping point when it seems as though local government, local authorities are rendering decisions that are very granular for their particular community without seeing the larger picture?
Well, I'll take a page from the, you know, 30 years that 830G has been on the books. The over third that time period, there a lot of towns have gone from abject opposition to affordable housing to a recognition, maybe not that it's a social good or the right thing to do, but that it's good for economic development, that you need economic diversity in your housing stock for your first responders and your public employees and so forth. And, you know, that's been the mantra of, you know, David Fink and others from the Partnership for Strong Communities. I think exactly what Rick's touched on, which is you need to prepare the message about where you promote statewide uniformity and control based on economic self-interest or social self-interest. But this, if you enact 5-acre minimum lot size, you're doing a disservice to the town. That's what people don't realize. And by the same token, you need to say, if we as a state outlaw that type of thing, people say, well, you're taking away local control. No, we're actually coordinating land use on a town by town basis, on a regional basis, in a way that will work to the detriment, to the benefit of everyone. That's I think you need to frame the message as economic self-interest and to some degree social self-interest, and not social engineering, not, you know, racial equity. I think that's the way to do it.
Right. Great. Any other questions or thoughts for Tim while we have him?
Okay, so the four towns are Middletown, Newtown, Watertown, and already mentioned Voluntown. So I just moved to Voluntown, so that's why it's my favorite question.
There's something weird about people who I had a thing about how many towns in Connecticut begin with the letter W.
A lot.
Yeah, I won't bother with that, but there's something disturbed about people who spend their time worrying about things like that. So, Tim, thank you for taking the time. I know you're a busy,
sure.
Busy attorney. Thanks also, Rich, for helping us out and attending, and also to Chairman McCarthy Behe, who joined and participated, and everyone else who joined us today. We will be meeting in the full ACIR meeting a week from Friday, at which time we'll also start rethinking what we want to do with the LGF subcommittee going forward. So we have a lot of work on our plate with the full ACIR, which we'll have to talk about next Friday. But in the meantime, thank you, Tim, for taking the time and helping us close the loop on this topic today. If there's no other questions or comments from the public, I think we'll consider them our meeting adjourned, and we'll see you a week from Friday. Thanks very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Keep your power, Brennan. Good luck.
Amen. Yeah, keep fingers crossed.
Brendan, was that letter okay?